Good morning, everybody. Here we go. Just a couple of footnotes. I brought another box of 40 books of It's Tea Time Again. I wrote this 15 years ago, and I've got 3,000 of them in my library. I have not sold one, not one. I didn't have not tried to sell one. I felt that 15 years ago, this idea was way before its time. And lo and behold, some might say that the tea parties have brought some sense back to some Republicans and Democrats. Some sense. Sense in the sense of our founding fathers, what they stood for. And so if you don't care about that, that's fine. And if that sounds old-fashioned, that's fine. But if you like the ideas of our founding fathers, it's tea time again. Give any donation you want, $5, $10, $20, and it goes this time to the class, for your class Christmas party or something like that. I do not want to make any money off of this book. If you haven't got a Wayne's book yet. I was talking to the president of Westminster Seminary on Friday, and we were talking about Wayne Grudem, and we were talking about this book. And here's my take on this book. Not everybody will read it simply because it is so long. But great, important books are oftentimes not read, they're just talked about. A lot of people don't read the Bible, but you talk about the Bible all the time. A lot of people, most people have not read Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, and yet it's a book that's been talked about for 200 years. And so this is going to be one of those books that will be read. Who will read this? Thousands and thousands of evangelical pastors will read this. And their life will not be the same again because it'll be, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. I really didn't realize that's how God viewed politics. That's how God viewed economics, etc. So my guess is on this book, it's going to have profound effects on the United States and the world, but through the passage of time. It won't all happen in a week. It's a book that'll be read and shared and read and shared. And just like starting from a small little stream, it will build up and be a mighty, mighty river. Wayne's systematic theology has had an effect on the world. This will be another book, I think, that will be that kind of profundity. Those of you who have begun to read it, you just say, how does a man capture so many details and then get it down and have it make such sense as Wayne works through the argument? He's got a one-of-a-kind mind, blessed and endeared by God. And so that's my throw-in on Wayne's book. As an outline is coming out to all of you about today, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. The world is in tremendous need of transcendent truth. Would you think along with me, along these lines, just what if we would not have the Bible, and what if you and I were not Christians? So if you and I are not Christians and we don't have the Bible, then for sure we don't care at all about the first 10 words of Genesis 1:1, we could care less. And it's just 10 words. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. 10 words. We don't have that anymore. On the other hand, if we do have Christ, and have we do have that. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Profound. Look at. When you're going to build a building, the foundation absolutely has to be right. Because if the foundation is right, then everything else is probably going to be wrong. Foundation is crucial. These are only 10 words. But in those 10 words, in the beginning, God. That denies atheism with its doctrine of no God. In the beginning, God. That denies polytheism with its doctrine of many gods. In the beginning, God created. That denies evolution with its doctrine of infinite becoming. In the beginning, God created. That denies fatalism with its doctrine of chance. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That denies pantheism, which says that God is in the rock, God is in the sun, God is in the moon. No. In the beginning, God created sun, moon, rock over here, God over here. Two very separate entities. So it denies pantheism. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That denies materialism, where people say, well, the earth and the stuff has always been here, the eternity of matter. No. There is no eternity of matter. In the beginning, God, and in that beginning, He created. And that's a different entity. The eternity of matter is a foolish concept. So it's amazing how many silly ideas men and women can come up with. We have, in just 10 words, unbelievable, transcendent truth to try to get this whole thing called life platformed. Genesis 2 then says, men and women are created in the image of God. Yes! Created. In other words, every single human being has dignity, value, and worth. Wow! In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and we are created in the image of God. Notice again, if you get this wrong, we're endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. But if you don't say that we are created in the image of God, all kinds of bad philosophy can come in. You heard me say a few weeks ago that the French were having a revolution at the same time as the United States. But theirs was not endowed by our Creator, King, Lord of Lords, King of Kings, but were endowed by enlightened government. I wonder what effect the French Revolution has had on the world. Well, we don't know yet. It's too early to tell. How many French would it take to defend Paris? We don't know. Paris has never been defended. Have you ever seen a French military salute? So, endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, created in the image of God. Where? With that philosophy, every individual counts and has more value. Each human being has more value than any country all taken together. It has profound influence on how you're going to begin to set out your philosophy if you really begin believe that we are created in the image of God. And then, of course, Genesis 3 then tells us about the fall. So we know about the fall. We know about the fall of man. We know we are born in sin. We know that there is none righteous, no, not one. We know that for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God's plan. So we all know that we walk with a limp. We all know that we are sinners. We know that. We know. But to believe otherwise, you think, well, maybe if we can change the environment, make change this or that, that men and women can be changed. No, no, we're flawed and we're in badly need of redemption and a changed heart. So again, founding ideas. Now, the thing I want to point out to you this about the fallen man is, interestingly, as we begin now to talk about the environment, is that the earth, too, is fallen. Genesis 3:18 says that we will have to dig out our standard of living from the thistles and the rocks and the difficulty of life. There's going to be nothing easy about this. There's going to be bugs and mosquitoes. And we can either choose to live with them or put a screen on our house and do the best we can to live without them. Or to come up with DDT and fight off malaria. We can choose to do that or not choose that. But the earth is full of adversity. The earth, too, is fallen. Nature is fallen. Which then brings me to the point of so much education in the last 50 years is somehow about how perfect nature is and how bad man is. Friends, those folks that say that have absolutely backwards. Let's pick up something in Psalm chapter 8, where Psalm 8 says, O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. All about you, not about us. You created the sun, the moon, the stars, the earth. And as we think about it, God, how did you know to place the earth exactly the right distance, 93 million miles away from the sun? Any closer and we'd have all burned up. Any further away and we'd have frozen to death. God, how did you make it just so perfect? God, where was the idea that you would have the earth spin on its axis 1,000 miles per hour? And is it spinning on its axis 1,000 miles an hour that it would circle the sun once a day and give us day and give us night? How could that be so perfect? How could you know just the exact right amount of water to put on the planet? 2/3 of the world is planet. And it not only had to be that way, but many scientists say even the depth, sometimes the ocean goes as much as 3, 4, and 5 miles deep. It had to be exactly right that we would have the right amount of hydrogen and oxygen on the planet. So even the waters that you create, it perfect in depth, perfect. And then how did you, with that thing spinning 1,000 miles an hour, how did it happen that it doesn't all spin off? Well, how did you create a moon that's just exactly the right distance from the earth, and it also circumnavigates the earth, moon does, to give us gravity, to hold the water in place? How could it be just perfect? And God, how did you think of it? How did you think to hang that earth in space at a 23-degree axis? A 23-degree tilt. So that we would have the seasons of the year. Without that, we would not have... God, what is this? It just seems so perfect. It just seems so perfect. God, there's so many of us on earth that think that we're evolved. From goo to the zoo to you. And you in your created universe made it so unbelievably perfect. And listen to this. Here we are, this little earth circling the sun in this galaxy called the Milky Way, and this galaxy having about 1 trillion stars. And then we learn that there are 1 billion galaxies like the Milky Way. 1 billion of those, each with a 0.5 trillion to 1 trillion stars, which means there's trillions times trillions times trillions of stars. And the Bible says that God knows about every one. He's named them all. Oh. I mean, it's just mind-blowing. Oh, Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You're the creator, the omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent God, the God who our feeble little minds can't even begin to get around. How can it be that you could create a universe so big that if we could fly at the speed of light and fly billions and billions and billions of years, we wouldn't cover that much of the created universe, flying at the speed of light, 176,000 miles per second. How did you do it? How then did you not only do all of that, but when it comes to humans, you said this in Psalm 8. And so, what is man that thou art aware of him? What is the son of man that thou dost care about us? You've created us a little lower than the angels and have given us, men and women, dominion over everything that walks and lives on the earth. What did we do to deserve that, God, that you create us in your image and then you give us dominion over everything that exists on this earth? But God does one better. Okay, so he does that. So he gives us dominion and we have stewardship responsibilities over earth and the resources. And he does, what if the Bible would teach communism? What if the Bible taught the common ownership of the means of production? What if the Bible didn't say, thou shalt not steal, i.e. private property? What if the Bible wasn't clear at all about property rights? And so we're going to try to make our way on this planet knowing that God has given us dominion over everything that works on the earth, but we're going to try it a bit of a different way. We're going to, if there ever was such a thing, we're going to abolish private property, as the communists say, and we're going to have the whole a government top down, command and control and run it, and nobody owns it. Well, if that's really then the mechanism that we're going to try to make it work, we have enormous, enormous problems doing that. We have problems doing that because it's called the tragedy of the commons. The tragedy of the commons is we all own it, so we all use it. No one owns all that grass, and so we'll all bring our sheep and cows and we'll graze. There is no ownership, and all of a sudden we all overrun it. So I'd like you to look at a note on your outline there, and I thought I brought my glasses. Yeah, I did. Okay. Boy, that would have been terrible. Okay, and I'd like you to look on this sheet on the tragedy of the commons. And look, we know this works with adults, but look even with kids. The last paragraph on the page, tragedy of the commons. Imagine 2 very thirsty children, each with a straw and a single glass of Coke. How long will it take them to finish the Coke? Not very long. If one slows down, the other one will get most of it. This is an illustration of the tragedy of the commons. When you're taking something that you want from a common pool, you are likely to take it as fast as you can. If you don't, someone else will probably do it. Everybody's responsibility becomes no one's responsibility. Now suppose that each child has a separate glass, each half filled with Coke. In this case, the children are not under pressure to drink it so fast. One child might even, while drinking it, want to put it in the refrigerator for later. As long as the child is assured that he or she has a right to that half glass, he or she won't feel pressured to drink it now. In effect, each child owns the Coke in the glass. Each child now has private property and will feel secure that their property will be there when they want it. So when God says, thou shalt not steal, when God starts talking about private property, that we have a right to own it, steward it, and management, then notice something. Go up just about 10 lines from where I was reading there, right in the middle of that long paragraph. And I say, what about farmers in Iowa? Right there in the middle of that long paragraph. What about farmers in Iowa? Do they take care of their land? Do they take care of their cows and chickens? Why don't we worry about the possible extinction of cows and chickens the way we worry about the possible extinction of elephants and tigers? After all, millions of people use these animals for food every day. The problem, of course, is that the animals which become extinct have no owners with a stake in their future. No ownership, no control. Here's the problem. The whale swim out there in the ocean. It's hard to get property rights on the whales, and so inevitably, what you're going to do is destroy them all, because everybody has an incentive. If I don't shoot and get the whale, someone else will. No one's going to manage that herd of whales, and now you've got big trouble. I've never had a student come into my office one time and say, I'm really concerned about Herefords and sheep and chickens going extinct. No student had ever said, why? Because sheep and chickens and Hereford cattle are owned and managed. Or did we not get a copy out to everybody? Okay. Sorry. Nothing. A dollar short and a day late. Here we go. We need one over here if you have it. Okay. But no one owns the polar bear up there. So if you don't go up and shoot the polar bear, someone else will. And because those herds of polar bear are not managed, are not owned, no one takes a protective interest, then who cares? And so there's a very good chance of extinction. Here's the point. So we don't have to, when the Pope came over from Europe to lecture the Iowa corn farmers, telling the corn farmers, steward your land, take care of your land. Don't let it blow away. I'm sure the farmers, their eyes glazed over. What do you think we've been doing for the last couple of hundred years? Iowa would have blown away, except we own it. We have property value. We take care of it. We bring machinery when the wind is blowing and the sand and the dust is blowing. We bring machinery in to bring it back down. We care about it. Why do we care about it? It's ours. We own it. That's the only way we can build collateral in our lives, is to do something with this farm. And to let it all blow away is not in our good sense. They should have said to the Pope, Pope, when was the last time that you washed a rental car? I mean, come on, Pope. We're not idiots. Of course, if it's a rental car, who cares about it? It's yours. It's not mine. I'm not going to wash a rental car. But when it's my car, hello? Just what God is trying to tell us about property rights and so on. So, the things then that we know intuitively about the earth and the environment is this. God has given us dominion. Oh, but you know what man is going to do? Man is just going to keep gulping the oil and gulping the oil until it's all gone. And so we sit through 100 years of scientists saying, well, we're just about to the end of the line, just about running out of oil. Then a new discovery happens, and we have more in reserve than ever before. Then we use another 100 billions and billions and billions of gallons, and then at the end of that year, we have more in reserve than ever before. Then we use, through this year, billions and billions more, and then at the end of the year, we have more reserves than ever before. What is this? Well, it's got to be scarce. There's only so much there. Where in the world is you? We're running out. We're running out. Really? If we're running out, why at the end of this year will we... Oh, this story gets better than having more reserves. Look at 10 years ago, every energy expert in the world would say, how are we going to generate enough electricity for the world? And the answer is, it's going to get more and more difficult, and it's going to get more and more difficult because, by and large, it's going to have to be done through either coal or nuclear. And for America, we've taken nuclear off the table, so we're going to have to do coal-fired 1,000 megawatt generating plants using coal. 99 out of 100 energy experts 10 years ago would have said that's how we're going to generate electricity. Coal-fired generating plants at about 1,000 or 2,000 or 5,000 megawatts a whop. Lo and behold, 10 years ago, they say we not only can drill vertically, but we can turn that drill bit around and drill 2 miles under the earth horizontally. We couldn't put a camera on the end of that drill bit. And lo and behold, what do we see? We see shale. You mean we could maybe put a fracking unit at the end of this bit, and this fracking unit fires at high pressure water into this shale and releases gas. And all of a sudden, the world's energy experts, Daniel Yergin is probably the world's number one energy expert, Boston, Massachusetts, his company is called Cambridge Institute. Cambridge probably has 200 of the smartest guys you've ever met in your life. But anyway, they frack that gas, and now Cambridge Institute is telling us, why, look at this. It looks like we have hundreds and hundreds of years of natural gas just under the United States. Why, look at this. It looks like we've got two or three Saudi Arabians oil fields, gas fields, down under there. Oh, God comes through again. Oh, no, we're running out. Man is evil. Suck, suck, suck. Please. God created it for us. We don't have to be stupid about this. But running out? Hello. Now, I don't want you, any of you, to lose any sleep about energy, because I've got to share something with you. First of all, we've got hundreds and hundreds of years of fossil fuel just in America. So for the first time in American history, if we want to, we can become energy independent. I'm not saying we should. There's some good arguments of why you don't want to become energy independent. On the other hand, there's some good arguments of why you'd like to. That is, you're not going to be so controlled by the Mideast and all that insanity that goes on from that part of the world. It'd be nice to relieve ourselves from it. But it's not all a win-win when you do become energy independent. So I'm not going to say one way or the other, only to say to you, if we wanted to, we could. If we wanted to, we could. And only to say that there's hundreds, probably thousands of years of fossil fuel. That's just one kind of fuel. But you think we're going to all be using fossil fuel to the end of time? No, because fossil fuel goes to $100 a barrel, and then it goes to $150 a barrel, and finally it gets to a price that hey, you know what? You know what? We can go ahead and photovoltaically convert sunlight into electricity, take it down to some storage mechanism. Now it would be something like a lithium and or a metal nickel hydride battery. Store some of that electricity. Plug in our cars all night long. Go out and drive all the next day. Plug in, drive. Plug in, drive. So is there any doubt that 25 years from now, 50 years from now, 75 years from now, I don't know when. I don't know when. I do know this, though, that when the price of oil finally reaches a point, will that be $125 a barrel? Would that be $225 a barrel? I don't know. And there, I'm not even sure the price is going to go. Because as this natural gas starts coming in and we start generating electricity with gas, life changes. Friends, 9 out of 10 factories of the future will locate their factories and they will not even connect into the power grid. They will literally have a small turbine-driven electrical power producer, vis-a-vis gas. A 10 megawatt. There's 30 carriers, aircraft carriers in the world. 30 in the whole world. The United States has 20 of those aircraft carriers. 20 out of the 30. All our aircraft carriers have a little small nuclear power plant on it to generate electricity. We will be getting our 21st carrier in the year 2014. And so that carrier is going to come online. It's a $5 billion ship and will have 2 nuclear power generating plants on it. So nuclear is obviously always an option. We didn't even talk about that. We're just talking about regular things. We're just saying natural gas. We've got hundreds and hundreds of years of natural gas. Point. God gave us a magnificent, wonderful universe of which our responsibility is to think and create and invent and innovate, and our responsibility then is be responsible for how we use the resources. So you have people. Now, these would be people, by and large, that don't read the Bible, could care less about Christianity, and so if there is not a God, then what do I live for? What do I get up in the morning and what do I live for? Well, what if a bunch of atheist scientists would come up with the idea that I'll tell you what you live for, save the planet. Well, save the planet from whom? Humans, of course. Humans are evil. Humans destroy it. Plastics, business, money, sucking of oil, using all those resources, blah, 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 which we've heard a million times. So, naturally, it doesn't take the press too long to get on top of this. So when I first became a professor of economics, here was the cover of Time magazine, The Big Freeze. So as we're beginning to visit in the 70s, the earth is cooling down. It's going to freeze our butts. 1972, Time magazine. The next one, it goes on, late 70s, the cooling of America. Now, this is so beautiful because if that isn't Jimmy Carter, I've never seen it. I mean, Jimmy Carter goes on national TV, sits and talks to all of us. He's got a cardigan sweater on. He's got a fireplace in the background and saying, we're running out of oil. We're running out of gas. And besides, the earth is cooling. We're in trouble. We're going to freeze our butts. The cooling of America. Cover of Time magazine. Earth is cooling. Isn't this cute? Then we go to mid-80s, and now they say, the heat is on. Now they say how the Earth's climate and the diminishing ozone hole is growing. And now they start telling us about global warming. Then in a later Time magazine, the Global Warming Survival Guide. There it is. Not cooling anymore. Now we're going to talk about global warming and the Global Warming Survival Guide. Friends, look, I mean, Wayne Grudem does not have all day, and he could put a book this size on global warming. He's got about 40 pages on the environment and some on global warming. You've got to read it, but I've summarized it for you to save you reading his book. I'm teasing. I've summarized it for you because on the back of this outline, are 8 or 10 pretty much geological atmospheric experts, and here's what they say about global warming. Only Al Gore could stand in front of America and talk about global warming when the last 10 years world temperatures globally have been going down, not up. Only in America could it be that the professor from New York University that came up with the hockey stick is, here was global temperatures through the thousands and thousands of years, and then just like a hockey stick, here's where those temperatures are. And so, in 1990, he said that by the year 2000, children in America will never see snow again. So, in the year 2000, they went out to his New York address and found 6 feet of snow on the driveway and said, well, it's like falling off a 100-story building. You pass the 50th floor and you say, everything's so good so far, but it's coming. Then he re-guarantees, I can guarantee you, by the year 2010, there will be no snow. Okay, great. 2010, reporters went out to his driveway. This year, it was last winter, the coldest, and 10 feet of snow on his driveway. Look at now. So now, by the way, global warming, global cooling, both. Both, depending on what's going to happen to the sunspots, there's going to be some. Look at, as you will see in the very middle article here. Once again, get on my glasses, and you look at the middle article, and this one right here, folks, where my finger is, that one right there, this one on that sheet. It starts out. Historical data suggest that from 800 A.D. to 1200 A.D., the Earth's climate was much warmer than it is today. This is when the Vikings settled Iceland and Greenland. They traveled in open sailboats with no cabins. They were tough dudes, but not that tough. It was warmer then. This is when Greenland, got its name. Oh, jeez. That's the problem with history. About 1200 A.D., you're reading with me, the climate started to cool. The period between 1450 A.D. and 1850 A.D. is known by geologists as the Little Ice Age, a time of high precipitation, much cooler climate, which caused many mountain glaciers to form throughout the world. The Greenland settlements were abandoned by the Vikings. I wonder why. And hard times occurred in Iceland and much of Europe. The Little Ice Age is believed to have been caused by a reduction of sunspots. There was no recorded sunspots during the Marauder Minium and sunspot activity between 1645 AD and 1715 AD. Since that minimum, the sunspots have increased and the Earth's climate has warmed. So, we go through some warming and we go through some cooling. It's okay. It's okay. A little bit of warming, a little bit of cooling. It's a funny time to argue about global warming in the sense that the polar ice caps in the Antarctica, that's the one down under here, Antarctica, are increasing bigger than they've ever been before. Admittedly, the Arctic Circle, that polar ice cap, is reducing in size. We might say to that, so? Mankind fights his whole life against cold. Cold kills way more people than does heat. And so if our system warms up another degree, and they were saying it was going to go it was going to increase by 3 degrees during this global warming. No, they've changed it. One degree. So? Okay, you got that. Okay. Now. It's so interesting that in the 1960s and 70s, here comes a biologist from Stanford named Paul Ehrlich, and he writes a book called The Population Bomb. He, by and large, has scared everybody into believing that, yes, here's the population of the Earth from the beginning of time, growing like this, and then we come out to 1850, and then we come out to 1950, and all of a sudden, pew! Population. So he says, here's what's happened. It's called a geometric progression. 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128. That's called a geometric progression. And that's what the human population is doing. And it's not going to be long, and we're all going to be standing shoulder to shoulder. You can prove it with bugs. That happens every time, those geometric. So anytime a person lays a geometric progression on you, it's simply like this. What would you take right now? Would you take $500,000 right now? That's one choice. Or I'm going to take a checkerboard, and I'm going to put one penny in the first square of the checkerboard, 2 in the next one, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. Okay, I've used up now one whole line. I've got just 5 or 6 more lines. Or so, would you take a half a million now, or what that last amount will be when we get to the 30th spot there? Well, when you get to the 30th spot, it's tens and tens of billions of dollars. So if you just took $1 million, it was a mistake. It can't be. You start with a penny, then 2 pennies, then 4, then 8, then 16, then 32. But even when you're up to 128 pennies, that's $1.28. I mean, that's nothing. But $1.28 soon becomes, and then doubling. So you take a geometric progression, and it goes, it's nuts. Human beings are like bugs. So they say humans are evil on the planet. And if you're an environmentalist, you're way more interested in the grandeurness of nature than you are in the grandeurness of God. And so you're nervous, Nelly, and you think population is going to overwhelm us. And so then you do things like the Chinese. We're going to fix this. We will abort 100 million baby girls over the next 30 years. And they did. So China aborted 100 million little girls, which then, by the way, leaves 100 million Chinese men without wives or women in their lives. And that is going to work? Thanks for asking. No, that is not going to work. Let me give it to you in a sentence. Long before China gets rich, China will be very old. Let me explain this. Economists look at something called a dependency ratio. Dependency. Who in our society? Children under the age of 15, they're in that group. people over the age of 65 they put in that group. And they call, how does that group relate, the kids under age 15, the people over age 65, what percent of then the total population is it? Right now, China's dependency ratio is 35%. That is to say, 35% of the Chinese population is either under 15 or over age 65. But as we look through the next 30 years, every year that dependency ratio is going to get larger. And by the year 2050, 2060, the Chinese dependency ratio will be 60%. It will go from its current 35% to 60% of its population over the age of 65 or under the age of 15. An economy can't handle that. That's just not enough hands on board. That's not enough producers. That's not enough creators. And so that's why I would say long before China really becomes rich, China will be very, very poor. Contrast that with India. Right now, India's dependency ratio is a little over 50%. But as we look to the next 50 years, India's dependency ratio is going to go to 45, 35, and 30% by the year 2060. So China is going one way with a dependency ratio. India is going quite another. It's a huge, huge concern. Europe, Western Europe, is not replacing itself. They're having 1.2 or 1.4 babies for female. You have to have 2.2 babies just to replace yourself. So Europe has not been replacing itself for 30 years. And so gone will be the French, gone the Italians, gone the English, and in its place, probably, it becomes a total Islamic continent. Probably. I can't imagine. Russia is losing 5,000 people a day from its society. What's the definition of a Soviet string quartet? The definition of a Soviet string quartet is what's left of the Moscow Symphony after they've traveled the United States. So they are sucking down quick and fast. Japan has not been replacing itself for the last 30 years. So Japan is not only getting hit now with becoming very, very old, and in the next decade or two or three, I mean, so old you can't believe it, but Japan is faced with a secondary consequence, is they've had no growth in their economic system for the last 20 years. Japan has been in a recession for 20 years. Japan decided that they're going to do capitalism a bit differently. They're going to do it like the crony capitalists do it from South America. They're going to do it with government telling the capitalists when, how, and what. And they're going to do it with the idea of Keynesian economics. Now, the last time I was with you, we said, In economic life, there's really two big schools. You're either the political school, the political means, and the political means, the worst of it is communism. The second worst of it is socialism. And then right under that is Keynesian economics, where it's monetary and fiscal policy run by the government. But the whole political means is this. The economy is just one big machine, and now you need smart people like Larry Summers and Barack Obama to be on that machine and run it and push the right levers and do the right monetary fiscal policy, and Ben Bernanke's and Tim Geithner's. These are smart, bright people, all educated at our best schools. So darn it, they're just a little smarter than the rest of us, and so let's let them run this beast. That's the way Japan has been doing it for the last 20 years. But it's been Zippo, recession, for 20 years. See, here's the problem. It's a spending problem. It's a demand-side problem. So you've got to do something to stimulate demand. Here's the idea with Keynesian economics. Here's a nice way to stimulate demand. Since the government multiplier over here is 1.5 and the individual consumer multiplier is only 1, it makes sense to tax and spend. Tax and spend. Because when government spends it, it's got a 1.5 hit on the economy. When you spend your own money, it's only got a 1.0 hit on the economy. So it makes, the more I can get from you and let government spend it, that's what's going to give the economy this demand kick and get this thing growing. Now, it's never worked in history. It's just foolishness beyond words. And Harvard has never stopped teaching it. So how in heaven's name do you expect Barack Obama to know anything about supply side, to know anything about Austrian economics, to know anything about the market, to know anything about entrepreneurship, to know anything about protected property rights, to know anything about collateralization? How can you expect Brock or anybody else that goes to Harvard when that is the framework which they've taught the economics? The political means, the government means. Government is smarter than the rest of us. The government has to do monetary and fiscal policy, blah, blah, blah. There's others of us that back away and say, yeah, right. Government does monetary and fiscal policy also. And when it does it, it causes recession. We've had 13 recessions in the last 80 years, and most of those recessions come because of faulty monetary and fiscal policy, including the recession we're in now. It's government that passed the Community Reinvestment Act. It's government that says bankers and loaners have to loan to unqualified lenders. It's government that did that. It's government that says we've got to move home ownership from 60% to 70%. And therefore, you're going to have to make a lot of subprime loans. But bankers and lenders are not stupid. They say, what are you saying? I'm supposed to make a loan to an unqualified lender? That's not the way the market works. That's not the way the market, and government comes in and says, no, you do go ahead and make it, and then we'll have government guarantee that loan through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And so you have Barney Frank from Massachusetts just beating on this drum. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Fannie, more, stimulate demand, more housing, more subprime loans, keep lending, keep. Barney Frank, this man, I would just say I'd like to put him in a mouse suit and put him in a box and then let you choose the cat to get in the box with him. I mean, the man. And now he's moments away from losing an election in Massachusetts. This is the, he's moments from losing an election in Massachusetts. And now, listen to him the last couple of weeks. Barney Frank. Well, I was wrong on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It was a big mistake. Oh! Big mistake! Big mistake! Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, guaranteeing $2.5 trillion worth of subprime loans. Do you know how much that is? Germany, the third biggest economy in the world, Germany, this year, 2010, will produce $2.5 trillion of gross domestic product. $2.5 trillion GDP. The size of Germany. We took the GDP of Germany, $2.5 trillion, and gave it to 20, 25 million unqualified buyers. So my Russian haircutter, he's been cutting my hair for 5 years, and obviously we carry on a conversation once a month, once every 5 weeks, and it was just so fun to listen to him. My wife and I have just moved into a $350,000 home. Well, good. Peter, I'm so happy for you. And. Then I'll listen to this one. We're going to be going to San Diego this summer. Great. Are you driving or are you flying with your family? We're going to drive. I just bought a new motorhome. A new $40,000 or $50,000 motorhome. He's a barber! Cutting hair for $20 a shot. But he doesn't get to keep all that. The shop keeps some of that. So what does he make? $30,000 maybe? $40,000 outside at the outside? bought a $40,000, $50,000 motorhome so he and his family can motor over to San Diego. How do you do that? Answer. If you have title to the home, you go to the bank and you take out a home equity loan. And so you get to use your home equity loan as your automatic teller machine. So this barber, what a life. What a life he's been living. It's just, it's the American dream. It's a thousand teenage girls from San Francisco buying $1 million homes. No income, no credit, no job, no problem. Come on in. Government is going to guarantee the loan, sissy Q. You're only 19 years old. You don't understand how the world works. We'll get you into this home, sweetheart. And by the way, if there's any equity that starts building in this home, you can go take out a home equity loan and you will have an automatic teller machine all your very own. What 18-year-old girl is not going to want to do that? Government. Faulty monetary fiscal policy. So when I gave this lecture, how long do I have? Are we out of time? Out of time. Okay. When I gave this lecture on January 21, Jamie Rasmussen went right to the phone and called his dad, who was an attorney in Cleveland from Harvard. See, there's the problem. His daddy is a Harvard an attorney. And so Jamie tells me the next day, I checked with my dad last night, and he says, you're dead wrong. My dad says, you know, the problem's just greed, blah, blah. So I haven't talked to Jamie about this for a while, but I've just got to do that. Okay, I'll let you go. There's other stuff on the outline, Wayne Grudem's book. Oh, I do have a few more minutes? Okay, thanks. We're not out of time. So, the political means, and then there's the market means. Our founding fathers, as you read in, those of you that did get the book a few weeks ago, it's tea time again. What were our founding fathers about? I'll tell you what they're about. They were first and foremost about freedom. Freedom is the mainspring of economic prosperity. More freedom, more bread. Freedom is a virus for which there is no antidote. Freedom is a country's best investment. That is what our founding fathers were about. Freedom. Some might say, oh no, they were about democracy. No, they were not about democracy. They were scared to death of democracy. They said that democracy is two wolves and one sheep voting on what we're going to have for dinner. They were scared about democracy. H.M. Mencken says that an election is just an advanced auction on stolen goods. No, they were scared. No, they knew that when you take from Peter and give to Paul, three terrible things happen. Number one, Peter becomes a pallbearer. Number two, Paul becomes an immovable object. When you pay people not to work, they don't work. And problem number three is piggyback replaces baseball as the national pastime. Our founding fathers knew that. They knew that. It was James Madison who wrote most of the Constitution along with John Adams of the United States when he says, we've designed this government to protect freedom from democracy and the individual from the majority. So our founding fathers were clear, freedom. They were clear that private ownership. They were clear, protected property rights. That's what they're, i.e. the market means. And no way do you say that the market is an ideology. The market is not an ideology. The market is just simply a bathroom scale. The market is you get on the scale this morning, stand on it, and it says 180 pounds, and it is what it is. The market is a stupendous transmitter of opinions while determining value. The market is an unbelievable communication system while determining value. Supply and demand determining price, wages, interest rates, profits, and losses while determining value. That's all it is. The market just says, The problem with people that live over here in the political side don't like what the market says. So they say, well, the market says that you got to pay someone at McDonald's $5.50 an hour. We don't like that. That is too low. So we'll pass minimum wage laws and we'll make McDonald's pay minimum wage people $8 an hour. Fine. Go ahead and do it. Do it. That's what we do. Precisely. We don't like what the market says. We'll override the market, pay $8 minimum wage. Now, they sit there and say, I've got two choices. I can either have a human being stir up and make these malts, or I can get a piece of technology, a piece of machinery that'll make these walls. I can't afford $8 an hour. Why? Because they're not worth $8 an hour. Surprise! Surprise! When you're 18, 19, 20 years old, you barely know how to pee straight. When you're 18 and 19 years old, you're just learning how to be there at 8 o'clock in the morning. You're just learning what cleanliness really means, blah, blah, blah. So you've got a lot to learn when you're 18 and 19 years old. So you're worth $8 an hour, $5 an hour, not $8. Okay, but you gotta pay $8. Okay, I'll pay $8. You're fired. So do you know what the unemployment rate is among teenagers right now? 22%. Because of this craziness. Oh, but these people are smart. These people are smart. This is the political means, the government means, Keynesian means, monetary and fiscal policy. Excuse me. Okay, I'm gonna end by saying that we have an election coming up. It is so painful to not have any adults in the White House. Are they smart? Are you kidding me? Smart? They're all Harvard. High IQs. Bright. Hillary Clinton could cut butter with her IQ. It's so high. So they're smart. Joe Biden, smart. Nancy Pelosi, really smart. But look at. If you're Nancy, this is Northern California, and this is the Northern California Church of the whatever. Here we are. And Nancy Pelosi has been your teacher. Friends, now we've got almost a week to go. Radicals, free market types, people that will use up all the world's resources. People that don't know how to steward the land. They could get elected. We got a week to go. Lastly, join with me. Save the planet. Would that get your juices going? You're sitting in Northern California and you have a speaker of the House saying, together. We're going to save the planet. Count me in. There's going to be, I've been saying it all year since January, I said it in my January outlook, there's going to be an electoral tsunami. But I got to tell you something. When the electoral tsunami occurs a week from this coming Tuesday, that's when the work begins. And here's the work with both Democrats and Republicans. But since Republicans are going to probably control the House after next Tuesday, nobody has to get this message more than Republicans. They forgot who they were. George W. Bush, God bless him, he forgot who he was. He didn't veto one spending bill in 8 years. And his last utterances as president of the United States, we need socialism to save capitalism. That's our boy. So you can see how confused they really, really are. Well, they're coming to their senses like crazy. the governor of Virginia, the governor of New Jersey, the former governor of Alaska, and on and on and on. You're seeing enormous economic sense. What's economic sense? Lower taxes, less spending. Lower taxes, less spending. Lower taxes. That makes sense. And that's where we have to move, and that's what we have to help encourage them along the way. I don't know how many more times Wayne's going to let me do this. But I will thank Wayne when I see him, and we'll just close and pray. Oh, go ahead, Ron.
Would you want to take 5 minutes of questions?
Sure.
If there are
any. I wish you'd have said that earlier. Yes, sir.
Why can't we get rid of the energy department and just make the free market our energy policy?
Well, of course. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Look. It's like the frog that couldn't get out of the pothole. His buddy says, get out. And he says, I can't. And then he saw him at a party later. And he says, how'd you get out? And he says, look, and I looked up and there was a truck coming and I had to. The truck's coming and we have to. Now we get to do some things that are kind of radical. Get out of the pothole, i.e. get rid of the Department of Energy, i.e. get rid. What is the federal government doing in education anyway? They shouldn't even be in education. That's a state and local issue. If you allow it to be a state and local issue, it's going to be amazing how much vouchers, how much free market, how much a competitivized school system that we'll see. That sounds a little bit radical, but it's exactly where we've got to go. Healthcare. We can drive healthcare costs, insurance costs down if we competitivize the system. How do we competitivize them? Health savings accounts. How do we competitivize? Tort reform. How do we competitivize that? Allow companies to sell across state lines and get rid of all those state mandates. All of those things would lower. See, when the children both sucking out of the same bottle of Coke with a straw. See, in healthcare today, $5 out of $6 don't come from our own pocket. $5 out of $6 come from an insurance company, a third-party payer, Medicare, Medicaid, anybody but me. So how do we practice medicine? Going shopping with someone else's credit card. We've all got our straws in the Coke. Ooh, drink. Drink some more. Go. How many MRIs do you want? No, give me more. You don't care how much they cost? No. I'm not paying for it. 99 out of 100 people don't know how much an MRI costs. Why? They're not paying for it. Suck, faster. And so we got 16% of the economy, blah, blah, going into. Any surprises? Like shopping with someone else's credit card? You think we're going to buy a lot of medicine when we're shopping with someone else's credit card? Do you? Okay, Wayne's going to invite me back for that issue. Okay. Bobby.
Yeah, just wondering if you would comment on where Wayne Grudem got his undergraduate degree.
I know. You know, it was so funny. Wayne and I are in Philadelphia last summer, and Chuck Colson and J.I. Packer. I mean the heavyweights, all like Wayne Grudem. Wayne Grudem equivalents. Stanford. Oxford, Harvard, Cambridge, more Oxford, more Cambridge, more Harvard. Everybody that was introduced, everybody, except me. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we have a real treat for you. We have a man here that has a PhD from Montana State University. Wow! It swept him up. This kind of firepower, you were able to bring this kind of firepower to this conference. A PhD from Montana State Bobcats. I wanted to crawl in a hole. Here's why I didn't go to Harvard. They wouldn't let me in. Can I say...
One additional comment. This is a public service announcement that because of the expected large turnout at the election this year, The Republicans are going to vote on Tuesday and the Democrats on Wednesday.
Okay.
How old is the U.S.? As far as
well,
under 15?
If you're going to measure from 1776, 234 years.
As far as 15, under 15 and over 65.
Oh, that's a good question. What's our dependency ratio? You know what? Our dependency ratio must be something like about 35-38%. And the interesting thing about our dependency ratio, as we look forward to the next 50 years, it's going to maintain that because the women in America are replacing themselves. We're having a little bit more than 2.2 babies per woman. And of course, we do quite a lot of immigration that comes in. So we really are in great shape for, as far as our dependency ratio. And by the way, it is critical. I mean, for China, it's really, really critical. Yes.
So we have $14 trillion of unfunded liabilities, and we have printing of money like
yes.
nobody's business, like the Weimar Republic. And I, my question for you is, what do you as an economist see? How are we going to possibly survive all of this stuff?
We cannot push it too much farther because there really is, like in all of life, it's a tipping point, and you finally hit the tipping point, and then there is no recovery. When you start moving debt to the position of being 100% of your GDP, as Japan has already done, as Greece has already done, when you start doing that, now you are asking for big problems. You now have the problem of there is no way ever to be able to repay that debt. So our national debt has been between 30 and 50% of our GDP over the last 50 years, between 30 and 50. We've now got it up to 85%. In another year or two, it will be 100% and then keep going on from there. So that's why the issue, stop spending. The governor of Virginia pulled that off in Virginia. They're solvent. The governor of Indiana pulled it off and they're solvent. Texas has pulled it off. Texas is only spending 17% of its state GDP on government spending. California is spending 25% of its state GDP on government spending. California has hit the tipping point and is tipping off the edge. And people are fleeing. This will be the first census year ever that California will not gain any congressional seats. On the other hand, Texas will gain 4 congressional seats. Why? Texas is fiscally responsible and have been. California is not. So we are getting to critical times, and it's why everybody's saying this is a very important election. But not just one, 2012. And not just that one, 2000. Look at the next 10 years. And so we either all get in this and say, stop spending, lower taxes, stop spending, lower taxes, or we don't. And if we don't, we don't. We'll hit the tipping point and tip over the boat. Because we're seeing that in a number of countries already, tipping over the boat. Japan, how do they get out of this now? Their debt is 200% of their GDP. Of their GDP. That's my signal to pray. Father, you spoke from on high. Thanks for this class. We ask for your wing of mercy and grace as we, as flawed, sinful human beings, make our way to the polls again to vote our hearts. We ask you to be with us in Jesus' name. Amen. Thanks.